I think the best way to begin is just by going to page 3 on this for a second. Okay? Just to get a sense, this is looking at politics for a second, but really I'm going to broaden this out to culture. So the first thing you'll see on page 3, you've got a map of the United Kingdom?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So this is the Brexit map. So what this is, you know, the referendum for Britain to leave the European Union. And if you look at the Brexit map, basically what you'll see there is that, sorry, this is intended to be seen in colour, but anyway, the basic point to get here is this. Geographically, most of Britain voted to leave Europe. Geographically, most of Britain left. If you do it by constituency, right? Think of kind of a congressional district or something of that sort. Most of Britain, most districts, think about that, right? Most constituencies voted to leave Britain. But there are a couple of places where there are dense concentration of voting to remain within the European Union. So did I say to leave Britain? I meant to leave the European Union. There are a couple of areas in which there's dense, these are these darker areas. And basically, London is the main one, and a couple of the cities in Scotland, and cities in Northern Ireland. And an interesting question, why is that? Well, basically, this would be a not uncontested analysis, but I'm just going to give it to you for reasons of time. The reason that London voted to remain within the European Union is that London increasingly doesn't see itself as part of Britain. It sees itself as a kind of cosmopolitan, metropolitan centre. It sees itself as a world city. It's highly ethnically diverse. It's very affluent. And it really has just kind of lost contact with the rest of Britain. And the rest of Britain has got that feeling. So the rest of Britain, think of the rest of Britain as Middle America. Right? So Middle America feels that Washington, D.C. and New York and Los Angeles have lost contact with it. And so that partly contributes to the explanation of the recent electoral results. But something similar has happened in Britain. The reason in Scotland that these two cities, you can't really see this, but I'll just tell you, a couple of cities, Glasgow and Dundee, voted strongly to remain within the European Union, is that they're welfare-dependent cities. So these are cities with very high rates of unemployment, very high rates of drug addiction, various things of that sort, and they're massive beneficiaries of European Union funding. So the European Union has these social funds and they're put into areas that have serious unemployment and other post-industrial kind of centres and so on. And Northern Ireland is the same, partly because of the conflicts between North and Southern Ireland. The European Union has put a lot of money into Northern Ireland. These are sort of rust belt parts. These are post-industrial cities. Used to be shipbuilding, used to be coal mining, used to be iron ore, all that. That's gone, money. And so you have two bits of the country, basically, that are voted to remain part of the European Union. London, sophisticated, affluent, ethnically diverse, strongly secularised, very liberal, and so on. And these pockets of post-industrial deprivation, but they're heavily dependent on welfare, income welfare payments from the European Union. Right. Now turn over the page and have a quick look at the United States. So these are, and sorry, once again I realise it's difficult to see these by colour, but basically you get the message that in the 2016 presidential vote, if you look at it by territory again, right? The obvious point is that if you go back to the United Kingdom for a second, just to say that, the population of London is more than twice that of Scotland. Right, although it was a close-run thing, but Britain did vote to leave, but it was a much closer vote because of the preponderance of the population in somewhere like London. Right? If you go to the United States, a lot has been made of the fact that Hillary Clinton won the popular vote, okay? But if you actually look at these states, counties, size of lead and change from 2012, one thing that's very interesting is that there's a very significant shift, right? And the interesting thing about the Trump victory, I believe, is that many people voted for Trump who didn't like him and didn't trust him, right? Who voted for him. But they were voting against the alternative. Had the Republicans had a more plausible and attractive and sort of slightly more moderated candidate, I think the victory would have been much larger. The drift in the United States is away from the Democratic Party in geographical United States. Now, of course, if you go to New York or you go to Los Angeles or such like, right, but you're getting the same phenomenon occurring in the across this, right? And the same, I could produce other maps. So just turn over to page 5 for a second. So if you look at Republican America, and then below look at Democratic America, right? So see, when people are voting Democratic, you can, I mean, I'm sure this isn't going to come as any great news to you, but it's essentially coastal America plus the big cities, right? Now, of course, those have very large centers of population, so that's going to produce a large popular vote. But for so long as you have a electoral college system, plus effectively constituencies, i.e., you know, people are voting territorially, as it were, because you don't determine this on the basis of the overall vote, you determine it via what people vote in given polling districts and so on. Although there are very strong centers of population voting Democratic in the United States, the drift geographically is actually away from the Democratic Party. And as I say, I think part of the issue of the Republican Party is that they've not yet been able to capitalize on that. I mean, they've not been able to do so really since Reagan. And then they had this kind of slightly crazed individual and so on, who people have voted for. Not, I think, in the deep, but I did a little tour of the United States during the course, in fact, I did two tours of the United States during the course of the election, and wrote a couple of articles for British periodicals, in which I just encountered people again and again and again, who said that they, you know, they had no illusions, I mean, that wouldn't be their word, but they had no illusions about Trump, but they were going to vote for him, right? Because they wanted to put a, they saw him as the best chance they had of putting a break on what they see as a move away from America they recognize. Mm. Right, so it's kind of middle American revolution. Now, those are just kind of, you know, so, well, here's the point. If we go back to some of this stuff, what's happening? Now, it's not just happening in the United States, it's not just happening in Great Britain. I could have produced similar kind of voting maps for Germany, for Holland, for Belgium, and so on. So if you look at most of Europe, one thing is very interesting, a lot of people maybe aren't kind of aware of this, most of modern Europe is very, very recent. Right? Germany didn't exist before the 19th century, Italy didn't exist before the 19th century, Belgium was an entirely fictional country, it was brought into being. I mean, quite a bit of Europe, which is why when the Yugoslavia thing exploded, it did in the way that it did, quite a bit of Europe is actually like sub-Saharan Africa. The boundaries of these states don't correspond to historical political identities. Right? They have other explanations. In the case of Europe, it's got a lot to do with partly with the religious wars of Europe in the 16th century, and then it's got a lot to do with the rise of nation states in the 19th century, and the coming into being of places like Italy and Germany and so on. Poland, I mean, the current borders of Poland were only determined after the Second World War. Lithuania disappeared, Latvia, Estonia disappeared, they've been recreated and so on. Belgium is a fictional country. I mean, it's made up of two populations, the Flemish in the north, French-speaking Walloonians in the south. Italy is a fictional country, in a sense. I mean, you've got the Party of the North now that's in the ascendancy, that wants to vote for independence, a secessionist movement. You've seen this in Catalonia, for example. This is breaking out all over Europe. There's a secessionist movement. The Bavarians are talking, I mean, it's not going to get anywhere, but the Bavarians are talking about seceding from Germany. In the Party of the North want to divide a line. Where Rome goes becomes an interesting issue. They want to divide a line in Italy and secede from the Union. The Basques are another group within Spain and so on. Now, what's going on here? Well, it's a very complex issue. It's not an issue, it's a set of issues. But basically, there are a number of factors in Europe. One is immigration, right? Immigration has been very considerable, particularly since 2015. Massive immigration into Western Europe. A good deal of it is people of Muslim faith, but from different parts. But it's not only that, it's more diverse than that. It was already the case, there was a very large North African population in France, for example, and there are parts of Paris that are simply exclusively non-French speaking. Just like there are parts of some German cities that are non-German speaking. And so one thing that's going on is that I think people have a sense that they've just that they've lost their sense of identity. They don't know what's happening to their countries, partly because of the reasons of immigration. But then this other thing brings me back to the United States and the United Kingdom, which is this kind of culture war, right? Between what you might call Middle America. Now, I'm speaking of Middle America here, not as a geographical entity, though it does correspond somewhat. I'm speaking of as a cultural entity. So some years ago, Georgetown, by the time you got to the Maryland-Pennsylvania border, you were in Middle America. Right. And Middle America runs all the way to the California valleys. Right? You go, I don't know about here, but if you go down to San Francisco, and go 60 miles east inland, you started to reach Middle America. I'm talking about cultural Middle America, right? This is part of the context and background. So what's going on? But one thing that's going on is this, that the rhetoric of disagreement is becoming increasingly intense. And along with, and what partly seems to many people to justify this intensity, is that they no longer regard certain other peoples within their countries, and I don't mean just immigrant groups, in fact, even particularly immigrant groups, actually, as no longer fellow citizens. They regard them as notionally fellow citizens, but they don't regard them as people with whom they have anything in common. Right? So, if you take, I did an article for a Canadian online political journal, sorry, I've forgotten his name, doesn't matter, but anyway, in which I looked at some of Hillary Clinton's rhetoric in the presidential campaign. I mean, if it looks like I'm sort of focusing politically, it's not worth engaging in an analysis of Donald Trump's rhetoric, because there's nothing in it. I mean, it's just abusive, right? I mean, there's nothing interesting about it at all, right? Rhetorically, it's nothing. But Clinton is quite interesting in some ways. And she appropriates the language, I'm sure she has no sense of this, of religious language. So when, for example, she described, whatever it was, a certain percentage of Trump voters as being irreformable and irredeemable, right? Well, the concept of the irredeemable is beyond salvation, right? There's nothing you can do to save these people. So effectively, if you describe part of the population, and a part of the population of the country that you're going to govern, or aspire to govern, as irredeemable, what you effectively said is that these people need to be thought about anymore. I mean, you might have to negotiate around them, as it were, but these are not fellow citizens. These are not people you have to... I mean, they're technically fellow citizens, but they're no longer part of the polity that we're concerned with. And now, similarly, so what's developed out of this? Well, here's the thing. In these increasingly fraught and tense exchanges around a whole set of cultural issues, there's a tendency to regard your opponent as either wicked or stupid, or both, right? So, because they don't agree with you, right? You set out your premises of an argument or a piece of reasoning and so on, and you draw your conclusion, and they don't accept your conclusion. So an argument not in the sense of a row, though of course they do tend to descend into row, but an argument in the sense of a piece of reasoning, right? Obviously has a structure of having a premise or set of premises and a conclusion. Now, there is a model of argument called demonstration. And in a demonstration, I mean, this is a medieval notion, well, actually, goes back to the Greeks, but in a demonstration, it's a technical notion, right? You proceed from self-evident premises deductively. So in a demonstration, let's just call this the premises and the conclusion, right? So in a demonstration, you've got your premises, and then you've got your conclusion, right? That's just premise-conclusion argument. In the case of a demonstration, these are self-evident. That's just what a demonstration means. It means you proceed from self-evident premises. Indisputable. Nobody who understands the meaning of the premises can deny them, right? And this connection, this inferential connection, is deductive. It's not inductive, it's not probabilistic, it's one of what's called strict entailment, right? So the premises entail the conclusion. That means it's not possible the premises will be true and the conclusion be false. That's just what this means. Okay. So if I give you an argument in which I state certain premises and I draw a certain conclusion, if that argument is in fact a demonstration, then if you dispute that conclusion, then either you're stupid because you haven't recognized these the self-evidence of the premises, or you can't understand deduction, another they're stupid, or you're wicked, right? You're just refusing to acknowledge either the premises or that Lucretius applied this conclusion. Okay. Now, the medievals believed in demonstrations, and I mean, that's to say, they believed their arguments had that form. I don't think it's now credible to believe in demonstrations in the context of any serious premises. There are no self-evident premises, basically. That's what I'm going to say very briefly. Okay. Now, that doesn't mean there can't be arguments. But here's a deep irony, or very ironic, that in the 21st century, you have sets of people who regard themselves, you know, as 21st century people, who are actually reasoning on the basis of a medieval conception of argumentation. They're engaging in medieval argumentation. That's to say, so supposing, let's take abortion, supposing you're a pro-life advocate, okay? You say, well, you know, a fetus in the womb is an innocent human being. Whatever your argument is, and we haven't got time to go through the detailed versions of it, but whatever your argument, your pro-life argument is, you take these premises to entail the conclusion that it's murderous, wrong to kill this fetus, to abort this fetus, all right? Well, if that's right, I mean, if it is a demonstration, the premises are self-evident, the conclusion is entailed with the premises, then anybody who's pro-choice is either just stupid or wicked. Right? They're not embracing the entailed conclusion of self-evident premises. Likewise, if you're pro-choice, right, and you give an argument in terms of, say, women's reproductive rights or whatever the argument might be, okay, and you think that those premises are self-evident, and the conclusion derives from them deductively by entailment, then anybody who fails to embrace the conclusion, let's say that there ought to be abortion on demand, or maybe it should be subject to some restrictions, but the abortion, broadly speaking, should be freely available, then anybody who denies that is either stupid or malevolent. Right? So one thing that characterizes contemporary debate, increasingly in the United States, is you've got two sets of people articulated at the level of journalism or public debate, or you know, however it is, okay, each of whom regards the others as either stupid or wicked. Now, how it tends to go, by the way, is that liberals tend to regard conservatives as stupid, and conservatives regard liberals as wicked. Okay? But smart conservatives regard liberals as both stupid and wicked, and smart liberals regard smart conservatives as both stupid and wicked. Well, they can't say they're stupid, so they're wicked, right? But you see what I mean? You've got to make a choice. Are these people just stupid? Or are they wicked, or are they both? All right. Now, when you start thinking of other people as stupid and wicked, one or other or both, then basically the terms of your relationship with them can no longer be ones that admit of anything like reasonable disagreement. Right? But the task now is just to isolate them. Right? They just can't be part of the conversation. You know, if you've got somebody in the room who can't follow the argument, or won't follow the argument, then there isn't anything you can do with them, right? I mean, you just want to contain them in some sense, or isolate them, or get command over them. Okay? And I think a lot of what's going on in these very heated issues, cultural wars and so on, is precisely that, right? All that certain kind of Republicans, for instance, are interested in doing, just to give an example of this. So let's take people who voted for Trump. I know some people who voted for Trump. I don't have a vote, I'm not a US citizen. People who did vote for Trump, who are intelligent people, who just held their noses when they voted, right? They think he stinks, but what they wanted was Supreme Court appointments and federal appointments, right? Or what they wanted was, you know, they might have two or three different things, right? They wanted to put religious liberty, they wanted to strengthen the provisions for religious liberty in the face of certain other. Or they want to get Roe versus Wade revisited, you know, the interpretation of good abortion. They interpreted a woman's right to abortion as being provided for under the Privacy Clause of the Constitution. So these people, if you think, what are they doing? Well, what they're saying is this: we can't deal with these people as fellow citizens, they're liberals. This is the conservatives talking now, right? Mm. We're not part of the same polity, not part of the same community. So what do we want? What do we want is just somebody to get hold of the levers of power and change the Constitution. No, we don't have to change the Constitution. So get the Supreme Court appointees so that when all these controversial issues reach the point of a Supreme Court, they'll be decided in favour of our view. So what you're actually using, you're trying to use the law coercively against your fellow citizens. Right? Now, I, for example, am pro-life, but I'm very anxious. Oh, not anxious, not what we're putting it. I have serious reservations about the idea of actually trying to use the Supreme Court to coerce your fellow citizens into a certain policy which they cannot accept. I mean, they believe it's a mistaken policy. Now, of course, exactly the same thing is happening on the side of. So the Supreme Court decision around same-sex marriage seems to be juridically as problematic as Roe v. Wade. But nonetheless, nobody cares about that. Right. What you do now is you just make any gain you get and you pocket it. Right? These are now not up for discussion. So what we're getting to a point is that the idea of reasonable disagreement is just off the stage. The reasonable disagreement isn't possible, right? Because anybody who disagrees with you is either stupid or wicked. So there can't be reasonable disagreement. Okay, so what are we going to do about this? Well, here's the first thing we've got to do, I think, is recognise that there is no such thing as a demonstration. Now, somebody might say, well, surely in mathematics or, say, in geometry there are things like demonstrations. Well, actually, first of all, even that may not be true. Because right? You can specify your axioms in certain ways. So you can get, so in some geometries, parallel lines meet. Right? Now, you know, so even in those very abstract areas, it's even a question as to whether or not there are strict demonstrations. For example, there are non-standard logics, there are multi-value logics, that are just true and false and other values and so on. So even in the most abstract area like arithmetic or mathematics, except conceptions of it, there may not even be demonstrations. But if there are demonstrations there, they're not going to help for the kind of arguments we're dealing with, because the kind of arguments we're dealing with don't have axiomatic premises in that sense. Right? Everything's up for grabs. Right? So if we talk about the status of the fetus, right? There's nothing that's self-evident there. Now, by that, I'm not saying there isn't anything that's true. So my view about argument is this, is that premises should be formed and sustained not on the basis of self, you know, but kind of staring at them and just seeing the luminosity of their truth, right? But on the basis of what I would call reasonable interpretation in the light of all considerations. Right? All considerations. And here's one consideration. Can you actually live with a given interpretation of a premise? I mean, is it actually functionally sustainable? So there are certain, so for instance, supposing you think that a fetus is not a human being, right? Suppose you thought that. A human fetus, I mean, what we call a human fetus is not a human being. It's not a human person or something of that sort. Actually, if you start to look at this, pragmatically, there are lots of decisions that treat the fetus as human beings. So, and recently, for example, let's take with kind of medical technology developing, keyhole surgery, and all sorts of things. I'll just take the United States, but it's not a point about the United States exclusively. People in affluent parts of the United States, let's say here in Los Angeles, are schizophrenic about the status of the fetus. If they want the fetus, right, then they invest it with all kind of status and standing, and will spend a lot of money to have rectificational surgery and so on done at an early stage and all the rest of it, right? If they don't want the fetus, then all of that is downplayed. So there's kind of two unreconciled states of mind here, which you flip between, right? So you know, very strong stigmatization of mothers smoking in pregnancy, drinking in pregnancy, very considerable interest in developing technologies that would allow for the rectification of abnormalities in early stages of embryological development and so on, and at the same time demands for very liberal abortion legislation and so on. And I think this is kind of all over the place. So, I mean, I'm not, because time is short, there's some things I've put here, but basically what I think we need to do is start to think about what arguments are. That's one thing we need to do. But secondly, we also need to recognise our human fallibility. It's very difficult to form clear, comprehensive, sustainable views of the most important things that matter in human life. Right? It's just very difficult to get an answer to these questions. What matters in human life isn't a simple question. And the answers to that question, or similar questions, are made up of what are known as essentially contestable concepts. I'm really going to have to stop now, not because I need to run, but I really want to talk about something. Essentially contestable concepts. So an essentially contestable concept See, let's take, that's the category I'm interested in, essentially contestable concepts, okay? So let's take, Bully, I ask this question. Ought innocent people to be killed? Right? Now, that's the sort of question you could think we could kind of elicit a general agreement. Ought innocent people to be killed? I've got to say, quickly, right? Yes or no?
No.
I gotta say no.
No.
We're okay, all right, fine. Right, now of course, the trouble about this is, what does innocent mean in this context, right? Now, there are, what do people mean in this context, right? If we're back to the fetus issue, right? What does innocent mean? Does it materially innocent? Does it mean non-threatening? If I'm an advocate of late stage abortion, I might argue that this fetus is not innocent because it poses a threat to the mother. It's analogous to a hostile agent in the context of military combat. And lots of people think that it's permissible to kill a combatant in the context of something like that.
Is this in response to Judith Jervis Sampson?
Well, it could be, yeah. I mean, all of this stuff is, right, yeah. Mm-hmm. That would be an example of that, yeah. Essay on abortion. But the point is, the quite innocent isn't, it's not clear what counts as innocent, right? It's not clear what counts as people. And actually, it turns out it isn't clear what counts as killed. I mean, it's clear that killed means dead, right? But it's not clear whether or not, if I act in a way that I foresee will result in the death of a person, whether I've actually killed them. Because killed is not just a causal concept. See, the causal sense of killed is, did something the result of which is that somebody died, right? But the moral concept of killed isn't like that. You can do something, a foreseeable result of which is that somebody dies, and you won't be held responsible for their death, right? So, for example, if I fail to do something that might be necessary for somebody's life to go on, and they die, it's not clear that I killed them. I'm not trying to resolve these issues. These are big issues. I'm just trying to point out that every word in there, innocent people killed, are essentially contested concepts. Right? We think they're not sometimes, because we don't distinguish between a concept and a conception. So a concept is, broadly speaking, an idea, but they're very abstract, like justice. Do we believe in justice?
Yes.
Yep. It seems like.
We're all off on justice, all right? All signed up. No. But now I give you a particular conception of justice, and all hell breaks loose, right?
Yeah.
So, to each according to their need, or to each according to their contribution, or to each according to a combination of their need and their contribution, or to each according... You see what I mean? So, we think we've got agreement, because we all believe in justice, but when you actually start to specify the content of that concept, which is what a conception does, it's a conception of justice. We all believe in justice, but it turns out we all don't believe in the same conception of justice. So this is why I say there can't be arguments like this anymore, right? One thing that's an irreversible discovery, as it were, over the last 1,000 years, right, is that arguments that matter aren't demonstrations. I'm not saying that the premises aren't true, I'm just saying they're not self-evident. So you've got to do an awful lot to try to make an argument. And here's what I think we need to... I mean, I'm going to stop now. So we need to understand the sphere of reasonable disagreement, right? Now, my view is, for any controversial issue, there are reasonable arguments on both sides of that issue. Remember, reasonable arguments... To say that arguments are reasonable arguments is not to say its conclusion is true. Right? It's to say such things as its premises are not self-evidently false. Right? So take same-sex marriage. I think there are arguments that would favour same-sex marriage based on premises that are not self-evidently false. I also think there are arguments against same-sex marriage. I've argued publicly and in broadcasting against same-sex marriage. That's done now. That's history. But the premises that I was using in those arguments are not premises that I think are uncontestable. Right? It's not like, well, look, here's an argument, what's wrong with you? Are you stupid or are you wicked? Right? So, Now, that doesn't mean that at this point we just all go home and think, well, that's it. Right? What I think we've got to start to do is this. First of all, be generous in debate, right? That's to say, the first thing we have to recognize is that other people's views may be reasonable views. I mean, reasonable, by the way, as I say, doesn't mean true. And there's reasonability comes in degrees. So what I want to say is this, you have to have, as it were, a comprehensive, at the end of the day, you have to have a comprehensive view into which you fit your beliefs about these different controversial issues, right? But really, you can't deal with the issues in isolation, comprehensive view. And this is where I think things, no, big circle, stop. This is where I think things like having something like a religious view, of course, not all religious views are like that. Some are very atomistic. They're not comprehensive. But having, as it were, broadly speaking, a world view, if you like, of which a religious view is a kind of world view, is much more interesting than just having views about these individual issues, right? You need to kind of set these within a broader context. And I think that if any philosophical movement or set of ideas is due for being revisited, it's a set of ideas that go under one name, but that's overly crude, is existentialism. So the existentialists from the 19th century into the first half of the 20th century were really interested in these fundamental questions about what is the meaning of human life, what is the nature of human existence, how is it to live authentically and such like. And there were Marxist existentialists, there were Christian existentialists, and within Christian existentialism there were Protestant existentialists, there were Catholic existentialists and so on. But the point is they all thought that, you need to form a comprehensive conception of life. Right? And then it's within the context of that conception, which you have to live. Right? And that views, I mean, they didn't put it this way, but I'm putting it this way, that views about these particular issues have to be tested within the context of a conception of life and a commitment to that way of life. So in many of these issues, people are just shouting at one another. They're not living forms of life in which these values and ideas actually have settled presence. So if you take, for example, the whole gay rights movement and so on and its expansion, a lot of this is still very kind of aggressive advocacy. Right? It's not demonstrating, you know, a far. I mean, it's too early to talk about whether same-sex marriage is a viable aspect of, right, we're only, this is all very recent at such time, right? So people have to prove their conceptions of life, but not just for themselves, but show that these are possible forms of life for other people. And so once you start to think in those terms, this induces a kind of humility, which you think, well, these are very large issues, right? And how, to what extent am I a witness to or a genuine advocate, not just mean a speech advocate, but actually an existential advocate, a living embodied advocate of the ethical beliefs that I maintain. And I think partly why we're in this kind of crazy situation is that people now are just holding beliefs that have become disconnected from any interest in actually converting other people or bringing other people into their domain. And this is true left and right, and I'm not. But that's, and I thought it was very interesting when she talked about these people who are Trump voters as being irreformable and irredeemable. What she was really saying is that I'm not interested in that side of people. And when you've got a candidate for the presidency of the United States or British Prime Minister or whatever else it may be, who isn't interested in a third to a half of the population of that country, that person is not qualified for public office. Right? Because what they're doing is they're just trying to get control of power. Mm-hmm. Right? And that's where we are. Okay, I'll stop. Yes.
While we see the significance of a coherent worldview or comprehensive worldview, what do you say, Professor, to those who would argue, well, why we need to get our priority first? Like, one conception of truths is that it be coherent, right, with the rest of your views. But suppose someone would say, but what's essential is that what your beliefs should correspond to reality, and therefore, no matter how comprehensive and coherent your worldview is, if it doesn't go in accord with reality,
yeah,
you'll have to change it. So
here speaks somebody who studied philosophy, right? So, well, I don't want to get too sidetracked into talking about theories of truth and so on. But you can either regard coherence as an account of what truth is, or you can regard coherence as a test of truth, right?
Mm.
So I'm inclined not to see I don't think that coherence is what truth is, but I do think it's a test on truth, and that's because I think that all truths are compatible.
Self-consistent.
So convergence in truth tells us that if you haven't got coherence, because now we'd have to talk a little bit about what coherence means exactly, but right, but broadly speaking, if you haven't got coherence, you haven't got truth. Not because truth is coherence, but because coherence is a criterion in the sense of a test of truth or something of that sort. Now, what truth is? Yeah, well, I think I'll go now. But I mean, what truth is a big question. But, you know, Thomas Aquinas describes truth as conformity of the mind to the thing, right? He actually gets this from a Jewish writer, actually, whom he quotes and acknowledges as such. But basically, you know, coming to truth is coming to get a grip on things, as it were. But I suppose my way of putting it is that, you know, we are trying to get a grip on things that are slippery things, that are things that are hard to identify in the dark, and most of the time we are in the dark, where we've got rather coarse fingers. You know, Wittgenstein says at one point, webs too fine for coarse fingers to weave, right? And you must have had the experience of trying to get a thread through a very fine needle, right? And realizing your fingers and you're just inadequate to the task, and your eyes are inadequate to the task, and so on. And we're working as if it was just everything was obvious in daylight, right? You know, but it isn't. It's very difficult. I'll just mention one thing theological. Augustine. So there's this tradition in Christian thought. Actually, an interesting question of what extent it's present in some stages of religious stages of Judaism. But anyway, this tradition in Christian thought that's sometimes called the doctrine of original sin, that begins in Paul, continues in Augustine, becomes very influential on people like Calvin and so on. But leaving aside what we make of that, one thing that Augustine says about original sin is the natural effects of original sin. So the supernatural effects of sin are the loss of the life of grace in the soul. That's the supernatural effect. But sin has natural effects as well. Natural effects. Not just the level of salvation and grace, but has natural effects. And Augustine thinks there are three effects of... when I say Augustine, I mean others would agree with this, but I'm just kind of citing Augustine. He thinks there are three kinds of effects of sin. One is a darkening of the intellect, one is a disturbance of the passions, and another one is an irresolution of the will. Darkening of the intellect, disturbance of the passions, irresolution of the will. Now, in a book written over 100 years ago, called Heretics, or was it Orthodoxy? Orthodoxy. G.K. Chesterton, page 1, he says, the one thing about the Christian faith that can be proved is the doctrine of original sin. And what he meant by that was, it's obvious that people's intellects are darkened, that their passions are disturbed, and that their wills are irresolute. So what does that mean? Well, it means that with regard to things that really matter, it's hard to know the truth. Right? It's hard for us to know the truth. That's the darkening of the intellect. Right? We don't have clear, brilliantly illuminated intellects. Right? We're working in the dark. And the darkness is part of the darkness that is us, as it were, right? Ignorance. But it's not an ignorance of a sort that I could just sort of give you the facts and that would clear it up, right? Because it's partly trying to understand the facts is what we're having difficulty with. Second thing is, even when we understand the facts, our passions get in the way, and I'm using passions in the broadest sense of this, right? I mean, all those things about which we can be overly excited or insufficiently excited, right? So obviously sexual passion is an aspect of that, but all sorts of things are, right? I mean, envy, anger, all of these things, greed, these are all as well passions. And so our passions get in the way of seeing the truth. And then the third thing that he's pointing to here is that even when we understand what the case is, and we've got our passions under control to a degree, there's still this irresolution of the will. You know, what I would do, I do not do. What I would not do, I do. Right? Weakness of will.
Can I do a follow-up question?
Of course.
What would you say to those who would respond nonetheless that in erecting public policy, someone's views had to be employed or imposed?
Yes.
It always takes a stance of a certain perspective.
No, I agree. Well, so here's what a couple of things I think. One is we ought insofar as it is possible, to try to leave scope in public policy for not to so constrain people that they become resentful, that they see that what's happened here is that just somebody has triumphed over them. Because what will happen in those circumstances is they don't respect the decision. They just see themselves as being victims of whoever is in power. And so what happens then is you just want to get into power, and then you want to reverse what's been done, and you become, and you can see that, you know, that's happened over the last several presidential cycles and so on. But you're absolutely right. Having said that, their decisions have to be made. Now, here's something, I'm going to say something here that will sort of worry some of you. I think that America has, so I'm using America because we're in America, but I could use other examples. Look, in the 19th century, in order to be able to vote, I mean, people rightly are outraged by the fact that certain classes of people did not have the vote. Okay. But leaving aside the obvious injustices of some of these restrictions, there were, in civilized societies, certain views about not who should be able to vote in the sense of what population should be able to vote, but that you would satisfy certain competence requirements. So in the 19th century, Britain, for example, and actually the United States, in order to be able to vote, you had to have a certain educational level and a certain level of wealth. Typically, actually, it was to do with ownership of property, because the thought was, it's only people who are invested in the states that actually have an interest in it, and so on. Now, we got rid of all of that, but actually, if you look at, I can't speak to voting practices here in Southern California and so on, but if I look just in Europe, for instance, increasingly, until quite recently, I'm sorry, until 2015, 2016, voting in general elections was in decline, right? And the people who voted were the people who had a certain educational level and had property, right? Because they thought it really matters to them who gets into power because of economic policy, what impact education is going to have on them, and so on. So in a way, we've sort of reverted to a situation that was the 19th century situation in which people who vote, 10 people who vote, right? Now, that's been changed in recent times because of this kind of insurrectionist movements on the part of, you know, what I call Middle America, you can call it Middle Europe, and so on. But John Stuart Mill, great 19th century liberal thinker, who was a great advocate of the extension of the vote, also wrote in the letter, he said that although he advocated for this, he had fears about it. Because he said, we have to distinguish between the wise and the otherwise. The wise and the otherwise. And what he said is, what we have to put in place are mechanisms that will stop mere majoritarianism. Right? We've got to create mechanisms that will block mere, because otherwise he's offered the prospect of tyranny and so on. And so that's why he was very interested in that. So, for example, in the United Kingdom and elsewhere in Europe and here in the United States, there's periodic redrawing of boundaries of voting districts and so on. Now, this has become corrupted, because currently the major parties just redraw those boundaries to reinforce gerrymandering, yeah. But the general idea of having a commission that looks at voting regions and so on is not unreasonable, because what you're trying to do there is you're trying to sort of mediate in some way that corresponds to some kind of fairness just numbers of people with outcomes. So again, to go back to the Electoral College, which is one of the great, the American Constitution is one of the finest political documents in history, there's no question of that. But the Electoral College is a very sane policy, right? Because what it was designed to, people, you know, in Europe, they forget that what the United States means. They think that's just the name of something like, US, right? But it is the union of states. And for the Constitution, the framers of the Constitution, what was extremely important was that actually this union should respect the autonomy, degrees of autonomy of states. And that's why the Electoral College is not proportionate to the absolute populations of territories, right? It's trying to sort of, otherwise you just have, which they anticipated. I mean, obviously, when thinking about where the demographics are now, but they were anticipating the situation in which small territories like Delaware, for example, would be dominated by, and we just think back to the 18th century now, by Pennsylvania, or what becomes Pennsylvania, and so on, right? So they're, and again, New York, and then they know, and then there's Western expansion, all the rest of it. People, the Electoral College is precisely an attempt to try to get to the situation in which public policy is not dominated simply by, you know, a raw majority. But anyway, so you're right, at the end of the day. Now, you know, my own view is that, about this, is that I think one thing that we've lost sight of, which, or lost a place for, is the idea of genuine competence. Right? So one of the ill effects of the mass expansion of higher education, for example, and education more generally, is that it's produced a kind of expectation, a notional subscription to the idea that everybody's being educated. Right? And the fact of the matter is they're not. Right? Now, in a previous age, people realised that not everybody could be educated. I don't mean for economic reasons, not everybody is educable. What you had was the idea of an officer class, essentially. Right? That's to say that you were just an elitism, right? You would just filter through education upwards until you got a kind of elite officer class. John Stuart Mill, again, who I quoted, the author very much associated with utilitarianism, says in one of his letters, it matters not only what men do, but what manner of men they are that do it. It matters not only what men do, but what manner of men they are that do it. And he was very concerned. He was the author of the British Civil Service exam. He was very concerned that there should be an elite, that there should be various stages of education. But he believed in a low school leaving age. So he thought that some people just, there was no point in keeping them in school beyond the age of 14. He wanted to increase the school, well, he actually wanted to introduce, because I haven't been a school leaving age. He introduced the school leaving age, but he didn't want to see it raised, because he thought it was contrary to what everybody knows, to assume that everybody can be educated, in this sense. So, one of the fictions of the United Kingdom, the United States, and recently in Europe, is the possibility of mass higher education. I mean, you can create it, but the only way in which you can sustain it is by changing the nature of what's taught in those institutions. Right? So most people who are in higher education now in the United States or in Europe and so on are not studying disciplines. No, I mean, it's just a fact. It's not a way of criticism, it's just a fact. Right? So I draw a distinction between disciplines, subjects, and studies. Okay? And a discipline, I mean, I'd have to say more about this, but a discipline is marked by the following characteristics. A discipline has a canon. Right, it's a set of texts that are quasi-definitional, but like discipline. A discipline has an enduring set of questions or problems with which it's concerned, and it has a set of methods for the resolution of those questions or problems. And those questions and the methods are themselves products of the canon, right? So that's what the great works within a given discipline have done. They've established a set of questions, a set of methods. And the fourth criterion of discipline, as I stipulated, is that it admits of genius. Right, so a discipline is an area of inquiry in which genius is possible. Right? Now, there are certain... Now, if you think about that, and then think of what's taught in universities or colleges of higher education, things of that sort, the big expansion of these goes with the creation of subjects. Subjects aren't disciplines. They are things... But English literature is not a discipline. Right. It brings together certain disciplines, or draws on certain disciplines. Social anthropology is not a discipline. I'm not rubbishing them, I'm just telling them they're not disciplines, right? And then, further down the road, even more diluted are studies. So studies tend to draw on subjects which have patron disciplines, right? Now, the percentage of people who are capable of having a university education in a discipline, I would guess is somewhere between 5 and 10% of the population. I would guess. It's not greater than 10%. If you've got 50% of your population in higher education, 40%, either they're not doing disciplines or they're not doing them very well. So you have to lower the standards in order to make it possible. So one of the great failings, one of the costs of democracy, as it were, has been this deceit that everybody is equally well educated. And nobody believes that. Nobody believes that. That's why when you apply for colleges and so on, you try to get the best place you could. I used to be my charge of 4 year old people. I said, to look, well, there's two things you might be interested in. One is where you want to study, and the other one is what you want to study. How well you do is less important than where you study. So we rank our degrees, the first class honours, upper second, lower second, third, all those with the rank degrees. I would say it's better to have even a lower second class degree in a good subject. I'm using subject now with discipline, right? A good and a hard subject, than it is to have a first class degree in a study. Right? And everybody knows this, but nobody can say it. Right? So we've got this because of this kind of egalitarianism.
And there are tendencies to convert disciplines into just studies, right? Metaphysics.
Say again?
There are tendencies
to
convert disciplines into just studies.
But, I mean, getting back to your initial question, I suppose what I'm really saying is this. Here's part of the difficulty that we have. We've produced a culture in which we've made the fallacious slide from the idea that everybody matters to the thought that everything that everybody says matters. And that's false. And that's what Mill feared when he said we must distinguish between the wise and the otherwise. Right? That his fear of democracy, of which he was an advocate, was it would produce a culture of the otherwise. Right? The belief that somehow, you know, that everything that everybody says has to be taken for the serious. And it's very difficult to do this unless people understand that there are things they don't understand. Because then there'll be an intellectual deference, right? I don't mean a personal deference, I mean intellectual deference. You say things like, I don't understand that, but I recognize that you do. So, you know, I haven't really got a view on this matter. Right? That's what intelligent people say. I don't understand this. Evidently you do. Thanks for trying to explain it to me. I think this is as far as I can go. That's fine, right? But people who don't have that kind of disposition, people who think that they're educated, right, can't recognize their own ignorance. And that's a serious problem. So if we talk about leadership in politics, one of the difficulties is that people can't recognize, I mean, what I mean is emotionally can't recognize, right, because they've been told that they're educated. And, you know, again, coming back to, well, I don't think I need to come back to the current party for the White House, but I mean, that seems to be somebody, you know, who on any view, any serious view of the matter, that, you know, I'll just come back to what I said earlier on, this is a man who's unfit for public office, because he has no sense of deference in the face of things he doesn't understand. But that's not a political remark. I mean, it's not a party political remark. I think it's a product, funnily enough, actually, given that he's associated with the right, it's actually a product of a kind of leftist liberal egalitarianism that has produced this consciousness that everybody, that everything that everybody says is somehow, because everybody matters, everything that everybody says matters. And that's a mistake. By the way, but when saying not everything that everybody says matters isn't saying that people don't matter. And that's the contrary mistake of somebody like Hillary Clinton, who just is willing to dismiss a third of the population, saying these people don't matter, because what they say doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. And so you see her contempt for people in that, right? Mm-hmm. What they say doesn't matter, so they don't matter. Mm-hmm. But then the other mistake on the other is, oh, people matter, so what they say matters. No, sometimes it does, if it's saying. Sorry, go on.
I'm just curious, what influence you think this kind of relativistic notion has taken play? Or, you know, because when we were talking about how premises are no longer self-evident, that seems to me like a product of this more relativistic mindset, this maybe even nihilist mindset.
I don't think of it like that myself. I see that it could give support to that view, but I don't think it's like that. I think this is a product of mature reflection. It's precisely people who, I mean, sorry, I'm in no sense a relativist, right? But it's precisely because I'm interested in non-relative truth, if I can put it that way, that I recognize how difficult that is to attain. So it's very important that this be voiced in the way that I've just voiced it. It's because truth really matters that we have to be humble about our efforts of attaining it. And we've got, and that's the right way of putting this, because that blocks the relativistic side, right? For the relativist, it doesn't matter what you think, in a sense, because there's nothing to think, right? There's nothing correct to think. It's precisely because there is something correct to think that I think that that should induce in us a proper kind of humility about getting things right, because it really does matter, because there is truth.
Mm-hmm.
But I agree, so it doesn't matter how you put this point, otherwise it sounds like it's a kind of endorsement of relativism.
So, do you think a relativistic mindset is a cause of kind of this super, or like this majority goes kind of mindset that we have, or is it?
I think it's deeper than that. I think relativism has played its part. Look, in the sort of handout thing that I gave, which you can look at, but I quote this guy, I don't know if anybody's ever heard of him, called Richard Weaver, who wrote a book called Ideas Have Consequences. Okay, so Richard Weaver was a Southern writer, a scholar of rhetoric, and an interesting man, actually, but he wrote, a conservative, he wrote a book called Ideas Have Consequences. And what he was really, what prompted that is the 1967-68 cultural revolutions in the United States. And he said, you've got these kind of people on the left, on the West Coast, maybe in Los Angeles, but certainly in San Francisco, saying all these kind of wild, things, and it seems like, America's gone on holiday or something like that, this kind of party mood, right? And he was saying, look, ideas have consequences. Right? I mean, what you say has consequences in what you do. Now, what Weaver would say, and what a lot of advocates and supporters of Weaver would say, well, we're living with the consequences of some kind of wild thoughts voiced in the 1960s. Hey man, just do what you will, you just kind of hang out there, and it's good, and that's cool, and all that sort of stuff, right? And now we're living with it. I think it's true that ideas have consequences, but actually I say something going the other direction, which is that ideas are consequences. So what I think is this. It's true that ideas play a role in how you live, but actually the much stronger influence is that how you live shapes what you think. Right? So we resolve our thoughts in line with how we want to live. Okay? So I think, for example, if we go to the abortion debates and so on, are driven not by ideas, they're driven by practice. So people wanted not to have these babies because they impeded with their lives in various ways and so on. And so they came up with arguments as to why it was permissible to kill babies, basically. Right? So that's a case in which ideas are consequences. I think there are a lot of examples of this, actually. But, if you want to get something done and people are in your way, then one way of that not being a problem is that they aren't people anymore. Right? Or they're not people that matter. See what I mean? So I think it's partly that these ideas have had certain results, but I actually think the ideas themselves were driven by some psychological and social and cultural factors. So, this is a much larger story. I think this is traceable back to the First World War. I think the First World War destroyed the illusion of civilization, right? That particularly in Germany, because Germany was seen by many people, including people in Britain that went to war with Germany, and certainly in the United States, as the peak of civilization. Right? This was, partly connected to Austria-Hungary, but Germany particularly was seen, in the sciences, the German universities became the model, particularly in the United States, for research institutions and things of that sort, so particularly through Johns Hopkins. Was really the first to implement the German model. But in the sciences, in music, in culture, in biblical scholarship, everywhere you looked, Germany seemed descendant. And it looked, and then the British Empire, the sun, the empire in which the sun never set. And this very well-ordered kind of polity, this well-ordered polity and such like. And then it goes to war, and they just destroy one another in the mud of farmers' fields and things of this sort. After the First World War, the terms of the German surrender imposed upon Germany penal, maybe rightly or wrongly debate this, but reparation requirements and so on, which Germany became deeply resentful for, and everybody knew from about 1920 there was going to be another war. Right? It took nearly 2 decades to come, but everybody knew through that period there was going to be. And after the Second World War, I think the world just went on hold. Right? They just thought we've had enough. Right? Civilization, you know, was an illusion in some sense. The idea that, you know, we human beings have reached some sort of stable plateau of civilization is an illusion. You know, life's nasty, brutal, and short. It's just time to party. And I think the 1950s and 1960s, this is where I'm saying ideas are consequences, right? But actually, after the Second World War, people just wanted relief from rigor, discipline, requirement, morality, and so on and such like. And you know, being crude, I say they wanted a party, but I mean, you can just think of the culture, youth movements in the United States and so on as a manifestation of this. Reading through the anti-war, you know, Vietnam War, because you know, again, this kind of not unresolved issues about America's position in the world, as to be a colonial imperial power and all the rest of it. And these strong counter-war movements, and then the, you know, the San Francisco movements and so on, the counter-cultural movements, and the women's movement, the gay movement, and so on. I see all of these as essentially pushback against the idea of a well-ordered common civilization. And then this is kind of advocacy of just living in ways you feel comfortable with. Mm. And that's where the that then produces the ideas. So I don't think the ideas are the cause of those. I think things like the Second World War, preceded by the First World War, were the cause of Western societies going on holiday, basically. And then, you know, living their lifestyles and such like, and then coming up with arguments. But the arguments are constructions designed to rationalize the practice.
I mean, isn't that what, I forgot which Pope, but Humanae Vitae, I mean, he lists all the consequences of kind of this liberalization.
Well, yes, Paul VI and Humanae Vitae, I mean, this would cause a big history, it would be a whole other story. I think that Humanae Vitae is badly written. I think that the arguments are not as strong as they ought to be, and so on. But I think that at the core of it all is a very insightful, prophetic, actually, glimpse of what happens when you disconnect sexual activity from the context of reproduction, and reproduction in the context of the family. Right? So the two things that, this is again my ideas are consequences, right? The two things, the availability of reliable oral contraceptives made it possible for women not to get pregnant if they didn't want to, and the increasing availability of divorce, right? Those two things together made women eligible for the workforce. I don't mean it, I'm talking eligible just in the sort of economic sense, right? It made a big chunk of the population that's hitherto not available for the workforce, now available for the workforce. And it also gave them aspirations. I think the women's movement is a product of socioeconomic forces. Right? It's not causal, it's a product of. I mean, there's a loop bank, so it does have a little bit of time. But it's basically the thought was, hey, look, you don't need to be pregnant. Sex doesn't mean pregnancy, or need mean pregnancy. And if it does, you know, well, there's abortion as a kind of backup. And by the way, marriage doesn't mean a lifelong bond. You don't have to be confined within that. That marriage becomes a kind of slightly ancient oath that the King of Navarre takes. It's a kind of conditional one. It goes something like this. I will be your people, you will be, you know, it's basically a Abrahamic covenant. You'll be my people, I will be king. If da 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 da, and if not, not. Right, so it means if I don't satisfy the antecedents of the contract, then the contract's off. So it's like, you know, consumer rights, okay? You know, if you bought it and it works, you keep it, right? If you bought it and it doesn't work, you take it back. You know, that's sort of these kind of conditions. So now apply that to the context of marriage, right? So you've got oral contraceptives, you've got availability of abortion, decriminalization of abortion, and you've got easy divorce. Plus, of course, the technology and all the, you know, so it's now possible to be employed in ways that don't involve heavy industry and so on, so women can start to come into the workforce in various ways and such like. Well, put all those together, is anybody really surprised that the traditional families kind of had it? And I think in some ways Paul VI, and he wasn't concerned with all aspects of that, but I think in some ways Paul VI saw the disconnection of sex from pregnancy would lead in some of this rate. Now, of course, it's had a further iteration that he didn't conceive of, which is the separation of reproduction from sex, right? Because of IVF and all sorts of other kind of, you know, cloning initiatives and things of that sort. So it's a further round. I mean, in this respect, by the way, I mean, I think people are very insightful. I mean, their analysis, or a source of insight analysis, is Marx. I mean, Marx is a, you know, Marx says that, you know, if you want to understand, this is very rapidly abbreviated, right? If you want to understand the moral values of a society, look at its material subculture. Right? Now, he didn't be a Marxist, you know,
By which he means?
He looked at the nature of the relations of production and exchange. Right? Just look at what's actually happening. Look at the circumstances under which people are laboring, producing things, providing services, and exchanging these one for another. So if you like, in that sense, the material subculture, right? So, and that's why I say, if you produce there something like reliable, this is a sense of this, right? Reliable contraceptives, if you make abortion life-threatening to the fetus, but non-life-threatening to the mother, if you produce IVF, if you produce, right? These are changing the material subculture, right? Change the technology, and people will start to relate to one another in different ways. That's very insightful. I mean, that's nothing to do with constructive Marxism or communism or something. This is to do with the analysis of what produces social change.
What, like, you know, kind of what Alec was talking about the relativistic mindset, what do you think is, like, a practical response to that sort of
thing? So now you spoiled the day, haven't you? Yeah, we were fine up to this point. Now you want to, what you're saying is, what can we do about it? Well, I mean, I think, first of all, spread the message, right? I mean, first of all, let's understand our condition, you know, before we can come up with solutions. I mean, I understand what's going on. So part of what I've been talking about is what I think is going on. So I think understanding circumstances and conditions have brought us to where we are today. Mm-hmm. Now, in some cases, you know, you can turn the clock back, and in some situations you can't, right? There are some things you can undo. You can just say, we took a wrong turn in here, let's go back and redo that. But there are some things you can't undo. One thing you can't undo is technology. Right? It's irreversible, right? There's no uninventing the watch, or uninventing the laptop, you just go on, right? There's no uninventing technology. And technology does bring about change. And if the relationship between technological development and the change is tight enough, that means you can't undo those social changes either. Because they're so interconnected with technology, and you can't undo the technology.
Could you undo the technology with better technology?
Well, that's just more technology, right? That's
right.
Just, yeah.
But you can use technology in a sense to then counteract that social change.
Well, up to a certain point, but I mean, that's right. But I think we'd have to look at the cases and what we, you know,
right.
The details of what we have in mind. But my point is just this, that, you know, sometimes you can say, look, we took a wrong turn in here. Let's go back to the crossroads, right? And sometimes you can't, because what drove you down there was technology. I mean, sure, you can modify the technology in various ways, but look, nothing's going to have the effect that the telegraph had in the United States that meant that you had to and then the development of trains and so on, I mean, transcontinental trains, which meant you had to reconcile times and places, right? In the past, it didn't really matter what people thought the time was in Colorado if you were in New York, right? There were nothing counted as to what time it was, right? But once you actually have the telegraph, then that gives you effectively instantaneous communication, right? So nothing, there's no going back to a world in which we don't have a common time zones and common fixes and things of this sort. Okay? I'm just using it as a very simple example. So nothing is going to... Look, you know, let's take... If you go back 50 years, 50 years, 60 years... Right, you, okay. Then I don't know how many of you have ever read Raymond Chandler, this great L.A.B. Well, his detective was called Philip Marlowe, and so he was American, was educated in Britain, and he wrote here in Los Angeles, and he has a series of books, which are classic crime fiction. The Big Sleep, The Lady in the Lake, and so on. Right, okay. So, at one point in this, gosh, I was going to take it away with Philip Chetmark, but I was like, what I was going to say. Where were we back again? It was about technology, about change. What was I going to say?
Is it 50 or something?
Yeah, I know it was, right. Okay, so I think it's The Big Sleep. I can't remember it's The Big Sleep. Okay, there's a character in this who goes to a bookstore in Wilshire Boulevard, or doesn't really matter, let's say there, which turns out to be to sell pornographic material, okay? And the point about it was that it was relatively difficult to come by pornographic material, right? Relatively difficult to come by. Technology means that it's, you know, you're not a second away from pornography and free pornography, right? But that's not going to go away. So there's a kind of step change that has been what was only available to princes and kings of the past, or, you know, people of enormous wealth, is now available to everybody. Right? But actually, if you think about music as another case in point, right? Live music of high quality, until really the invention of the phonograph, was unavailable to all but, you know, the only way you could hear, sorry, not to say live music, the only way in which you could hear classical music performed was to be in the presence of the performer, right? And how many people were in that position, right? So these are cases in which technology has produced irreversible change. So, you know, the fact we're going to have to live with this, if you take, say, sexual relations or things of that sort, is that it's now going to just be much, much harder to form people in a way of thinking about sexual relationships and personal relationships.
Wow.
In ways that were sustained by a kind of protective veil of relative innocence. So you could stage people's discovery, you know. Now, you know, any kid that's got a computer is there in one step, right? So how do you do that? I'm not being unduly pessimistic, I'm just trying to say that if we try to give answers to these things, they're not going to be, it's not going to take the form of going backwards, right? You can't undo any of that. So, part of this will only come, I think, and this is often the way of things, when what we've produced collapses, right?
Wow.
And it is, in part, collapsing. So one thing that I've become kind of more familiar with, but with my students, is that the number of students, pupils in schools as well, I mean, who come from broken homes of one kind or another, is just kind of off the scale, right? So St Andrews in Scotland, you could be in St Andrews, you'd be in St Andrews, right? It's a tiny town, okay? The population of 100,000, medieval town. But the Catholic primary school there, elementary school, or four of my children went there, so I know it very well, is sociologically no different from a non-Catholic school in terms of, if you actually probe into the backgrounds of the homes and so on, right? They're dysfunctional in various ways. All the problems that are out there, kind of there. And children are growing up that are beginning to kind of come to consciousness of this. That they're actually, in a sense, they never had a chance. You know, they're so, I mean, rates of alcohol addiction are growing. I mean, sorry, I don't just mean people, but I mean at younger ages and so on. Various kinds of addictions and so on. Pathologies, that violence among young people and so on. All of these are growing, and, you know, a generation is going to ask themselves the question, you know, why did you give us this? Why did you make us like this?
Mm.
Right? And then, sort of, but these are, how that happens is not mass movements, right? It's people here finding other people there, which is why these kind of groups you belong to are very interesting, I think, right? It's finding, it's kind of lifeboat methods, right? It's just, they're not even lifeboats, right? I mean, they're upturned bits of the wreckage, right? That somebody grips onto, and somebody grips onto them, you know? And then somebody's bright enough to gather a few bits of wreckage together and tie them together with a rope, and then somebody thinks, well, look, it doesn't need to be wreckage, we can build it, you know, this kind of thing. But that's how I think this comes. And that's why I go all the way back to what I said earlier on. It's not about focusing on premises in an argument. It's about developing a sense of life and living it.
Yeah.
And then those will be the magnets for other people.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, this isn't, we're not talking about transforming the culture in the sense in which somebody thinks, oh, we're going to put the whole thing back together again. Right? You know, one or two generations on, then we'll be back together again. That's not going to happen. You know, and of course the other thing is we've got a crazed sense of presentism. You know, people are incapable, because the technology contributes this, you know, social media, 24-hour news, multiple media channels and so on. You know, I grew up in a world in which there were two television channels, right? And the television went off at 9 o'clock at night so you could put the children to bed. Right? So, I mean, that was very protective of family. But the situation which we're in now is such that, you know, there's no... That can't be put back in the bottle, right? That's not... But what you can do is just try to, you know, find people who recognize they have the same diagnosis and start to build. And that's happening, I think. Yeah, that is happening, actually. It's quite interesting. The reason I'm at Baylor is Baylor is the largest Baptist university, right? And here I am, a Roman Catholic, who's gone to teach in a Baptist university. Why? Well, because I think that, you know, there are a number of things that are happening there that are very interesting. And, you know, you've got to find some bit of wreckage you get a grip on it, or try and bind a few bits of wreckage together, and so on. So that's how I think it goes. And after all, there is historical precedent for this, right?
Mm-hmm.
Going back 2,000 years. The group of people who went to Ephesus and Antioch and Corinth and so on.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't a mass movement.
I have a question.
Yeah.
When it comes to kind of the inability to have self-evident premises,
yes,
to debate on, or even to have civil discussion about, what do you think are some of the closest things of common ground to start building that conversation?
Okay, well, I think that... So here's one, all right, which is quite a substantial one, actually. I think that everybody in this room... I think everybody in this room, I think if we walk the corridors and have a conversation with you, everybody around here, has a conception of themselves as free and equal persons. Right? Now, what do I mean by that? Well, I mean this, that each of you in this room thinks that in some sense I don't have any right, or nobody else has any right, to coerce them with regard to what it is that they should think.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And each person in this room thinks that they have a legitimate claim to be heard. I don't mean because of the truth of what they say, but because they are just what they are, persons.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But you can't demand that for yourself and not accord it to others. That's irrational. Right? There's, none of us is, from this point of view, right? In life it's important to see yourself both from your own perspective, but also to see yourself as one among many. Right? You have to hold these two together. If you don't see yourself from your own perspective, then you lose your identity, as we just dissolve into the mass. But if you don't see the others as equally real, then you become a kind of, clinical solipsist, right? You just don't believe in the reality of other people, or they don't matter. Now, it's very important, therefore, to keep together these two things. So if I claim my right to be heard, there's nothing special about me that accords me that right, that isn't a right for everybody else. So in asking that you honour or recognise or respect that right, I am logically, by implication, granting that right to you also. I can give you no reason to accord me that right that isn't a reason to accord yourself that right. Or equally, you can give me no reason why you should be accorded that right, or everybody else in the room shouldn't be accorded that right. Because these are not based on competency. They're just based on being there, or being one of us as well. So that sense of a community of free and equal persons, I think that's pretty much it. I don't mean it's self-evident, because I've had to say a few things to start to motivate it, right? So I don't think it's just like people feel like, well, that's true. Yeah. Right, so you need to say things to get the idea across. But once you've got that idea across, that seems to me as close to incontrovertible. That's a pretty good start, right? It's not even a trivial thing. It's a pretty deep and important thing. So I think that's how you proceed. You say, okay, well, now where does that take us to? Well, maybe I recognize that each of us has in some sense both an obligation and a duty to try to act in accord with what we believe to be true. Right? So then that should induce in us a certain kind of tolerance. Corey. See, just to give an example, the concept of toleration has been grossly distorted in recent years. And the reason for that is, again, it's that ideas have been driven by ideas of the consequence of how people are choosing to live. All right, we're done, okay?
Thank you,
Professor.